Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi. I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. This is Rob Lamb, and look who it is. Look who's back. It's none other than Joe McCormick.
Oh, feels good to be back, man.
Yeah, great to have you back. What is life like now? Can you want to share anything with the viewers? You're now Joe McCormick, the dad.
It's true. I have entered daddom. My wife and I had a baby girl back in October, so I've been on parental leave for I don't even know how long at this point. It just seems like, you know, a lifetime in the blink of an eye at once. Our daughter is a wonderful little creature. She's chirping and she's making goblin noises. It's beautiful. But duty calls, so after my hiatus, here I am, back on mic.
Well, again, congrats. I was so glad everything's working out so well. And certainly, we've heard from a number of listeners who were very much cheering you on, but also were excited for you coming back. And one thing that Seth and I talked about, too, while you were out, we were like, well, some people might have started listening to the show just 5 weeks ago. And if that is the case, they have just been told about the coming of Joe, that Joe is coming. Joe shall return to us. And lo and behold, Joe has returned here on an episode of Weird House Cinema.
I come covered in spit up and bearing really boring stories. I don't know if you noticed this about becoming a parent, that you spend all your day taking care of this child, and it's incredibly meaningful to you, but it really does not amount to much that you can tell anyone else. There aren't really especially notable anecdotes or occurrences. It's just like, well, she looked at me, or like, you know, oh yeah, and I was holding her, and then she spit up, and then I don't know. I mean, it's the most wonderful thing ever, but it just doesn't really make for a good story.
Yeah, there is a lot of stuff like that, But in a way, it's amazing you have such self-awareness about it, because I certainly remember just being amazed by all these little things and then talking about them, but also being sort of a crazy person in the new days of parenthood, and therefore not really being able to tell or read the room about how much anyone wants to hear about all of this.
Oh, no, I've already done that. I think now I've sort of reached a point of clarity of like, okay, I'm going to stop boring people telling stories about how she looked at me.
But I am excited to see where this takes future episodes of especially Stuff to Blow Your Mind core episodes, because it does bring new insights. It makes you rethink things about human nature, about learning development of the human being. It really turns a lot of our preconceived notions and expectations of humanity on its head in an often delightful way.
Absolutely. You listeners, you may expect years to come of Baby Looked at You themed episodes.
Well, I don't know how sleep deprived you are at the moment, Joe, but are you ready to discuss a cinematic classic from 1954 titled Tobor the Great.
Oh, am I. Boy, Tobor is just running through my veins right now. Tobor the Great, 1954 science fiction thrill ride, a film about an emotionally volatile psychic robot and the boy who became his friend. So this movie got me thinking about how a lot of science fiction movies have a robot in them. But Tobor the Great comes from an era when the fact that there is a robot is plot enough in itself. And by the way, if you have any concerns that the characters in this movie will not say Tobor enough, let us put your fears to rest. You will hear talk of Tobor. You will see Tobor with your eyes. And by the end, you will believe in Tobor.
Now, one of the interesting things about this is when you think about classic 1950s robots, you often think about Robbie the Robot from 1956's Forbidden Planet, which we were actually talking about covering on Weird House at some point. But this predates Robbie the Robot. Or at least it predates Robbie the Robot's appearance in Forbidden Planet. We have to remember that Robbie the Robot is essentially a robot actor. On Internet Movie Database, Robbie the Robot has his own profile as if he is like a dog actor or a human actor.
I gotta say, as much as I love Tobor, if I'm being serious, Tobor does not really achieve the heights of Robbie the Robot in terms of feeling and dramatic intensity.
At the same time, though, I feel like Tobor is a pretty good robot design. He has an interesting face that that reads a little differently compared to some of the cheaper big robot costumes of this time period and the decade to follow.
I watched it with Rachel, and she kept reading Tobor's eyes as a light-up 1950s bullet bra.
It does kind of look like the front of a Buick or something in ways. But yeah, there's a lot of interesting chrome in this film. There's a lot of gadgetry. I was really admiring the use of clear plastic or acrylic panels. There's a lot of custom metalwork in this film. So I'd say in general, when we were first looking into this film, I'm noticing some people talking about it, kind of putting it down as if this is just kind of a cheap affair. And yeah, this is not a huge budget film. This is not a classic of 50s sci-fi, perhaps. But I feel like it's really well done. I feel like it holds up pretty well. And more thought went into it and more work went into it than you might think would be required for a film of this caliber.
Yes, it is by no means, it's not Forbidden Planet, but it is a rollicking good time.
Yeah, and it's essentially a kid's movie.
So Rob, were you saying I didn't even realize this was the case, but were you saying we have a tradition of doing robot movies around the holidays? It is December now, I guess.
Essentially, I mean, this is only the third Christmas of Weird House Cinema. But yeah, we did Robot Jocks around Christmas
one year.
We did the Super Inframan around Christmas one year, and I would say that sort of counts because any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from Inframan.
Yes, great point.
And we also kind of steer towards doing films that feel like something you'd find under the Christmas tree.
Yes. And, you know, Rob, when I pitched this movie to you for my return episode of Weird House, I promised that there would be a very subtle holiday tie-in, seeing as we have entered December now. And while I'm sad to report that Tobor the Great is not in itself a Christmas robot, before I found out about this movie, I already had an association with the word Tobor, which was...
This is Tobor. Tobor, the telesonic robot. Batteries not included. He's under your control. With a click from the telesonic commander, to circle, to proceed forward, to circle, or to pick up the support module and return, all on your command. Tobor is robot spelled backwards. Tobor, the telesonic robot from Shopper.
Rob, did you know this commercial before? I love the eerie music in it. It sounds almost like it's a little bit menacing.
yeah. This is really cool. I certainly didn't watch this one as a kid. It's a little too old for me to have any genuine nostalgia for.
Well, the original place I encountered this commercial was within one of the breaks in the copy I saw of the Star Wars Holiday Special.
Oh, yeah.
Gotta love the commercials in whatever tape you've seen of the holiday special, you know, alongside the classics like the Ladies Garment Workers Union and their awesome theme song, which I, every time I watch the holiday special, I'm singing the Garment Workers song for days afterwards. It's even catchier than the Starship song. But as far as I can tell, Tobor the Telesonic Robot is unrelated to Tobor the Great. It's just evidence that, spectacular minds think alike, and at least two different creative geniuses across the past century noticed that Tobor is robot spelled backwards. That's gold. Now, I have another question before we start talking about cast or plot or anything, which is, why do you think it was called Tobor the Great? It's a name that it invites comparisons, like I've been walking around calling him Tobor Magnus or Tobor Augustus. The Great is an epithet often describing a military conqueror or a supposedly beloved autocratic despot. But at least within the runtime of the film, Tobor neither conquers territory nor becomes a king or emperor. So in what sense is he the Great?
I mean, he's a great friend that you can rely That's true. On, I guess. But Tobor the Great Friend, that makes it sound like it's a movie about a dog. And maybe Tobor itself kind of sounds like a movie about a dog. Maybe Tobor the Great, I don't know, that could be a movie about a dog too. Could be some sort of a great breed of dog, right?
Well, yeah, maybe it's recasting the idea of greatness. Like, it's better to be a good friend than it is to be a military conqueror, I think. But yeah, I don't know. It's a strange choice because Tobor's range of action in this movie is actually rather limited. He mostly hangs out in one house and then goes to a different building at the end.
Yeah. His movements are difficult to watch. I kept expecting, there's a terrifying scene where Tobor the Great climbs a spiral wrought iron staircase. I was legitimately on the edge of my seat because I'm like, oh, this poor actor is going to fall. Like, this just looks very dangerous.
There are close-ups on his feet. Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah, the feet of this costume are also like weird stilts of some sort, so it looks extra shaky.
It's like a movie with a close up where somebody's like eating off of a knife and they're showing you close ups of their mouth.
Yes. I can't wait to discuss some of the action scenes with Tobor that occur later in the film.
So I guess we should do an elevator pitch, which is a doddering old professor creates an emotional telepathic robot in order to pilot dangerous space missions. This robot is named Tobor, and he's a friend to all children. But nefarious Soviet spies want to steal the secret of Tobor in order to unleash evil and destruction upon the human race. Will the Red Menace seize control of Tobor's mind? Or will the love of a child keep Tobor on the path of righteousness?
All right, let's hear that audio from the trailer.
Tobor, the most amazing, the most fantastic creation of man's mind.
Oh, he looks alive.
For Tobor can live where no human can breathe, in the airless atmosphere of outer space. And the nation first to conquer space controls the world. Electronic scientists have designed a practical spaceship. Atomic power makes space travel possible, needing only the most valuable of all secret scientific achievements. Space-conquering giants that man can control.
Tobor is alive. For even though much work remains before he's completed, he is already a sentient being, a necessary adjunct to the recording of all experiences our human space crews may later encounter.
Since we cannot get in to see Nordstrom's secrets for ourselves, we must induce him to come out and tell them to us.
They have no news of Professor Nordstrom or the boy. Neither has the Los Angeles Police Department nor the FBI.
I take it you want the formulae for my extrasensory transmission method.
Gramps, don't you tell him! Don't you do it! Please, don't you tell him! Go, Gramps, go!
All right! You win.
Tobor, bringing you chills you've never known before. Tobor, the most human outer space man ever seen on Earth. Be sure to see Tobor.
All right. Sounds exciting. Sounds pretty great. Now, if you're wanting to watch this film as well, and you're wondering where you can get it, basically, the main place to find it is if you want a physical media. There's a 2017 Kino Lorber Studio Classics Blu-ray release of the film. This is remastered. You can also find various versions of it online. This is an older film. There was one in particular we were looking at that had some unofficial remastering and colorization of the film, which is normally not the sort of thing I'd go for, but I don't know. With a film like this, I feel like it kind of benefits from that sort of treatment.
I agree. I don't know who did this colorization, and I'm not going to say that it looks amazing, but it's the right way to watch it.
Yeah, it's weird. It's uncanny at times, which I like an uncanny sheen on a film like this. All right, well, let's start talking about who was involved in the creation of this picture. So let's start at the top. The director was Lee Sholem, also known as Lee Rollem Sholem for cranking them out. And he did really crank them out. He directed various adventure shows and series in the 1950s, including episodes of Tarzan and Superman Adventures. He actually did 14 episodes of the early 1950s Adventures of Superman. He's credited as a director on the TV series Criswell Predicts.
Oh!
Yeah.
From that connecting to Plan 9 from Outer Space. You may recall the opening of that film is a Criswell Predicts segment where they had this TV psychic on talking about how future events such as these will affect you in the future.
Yeah, so Sholem seems to have been involved in that. He did a lot of TV late in his career. Two other films of note include the 1957 movie Pharaoh's Curse, which, as you can imagine, is some sort of an Egyptian curse film. But he also did 1967's Catalina Caper, which was an MST3K selection.
Oh, I remember that one. Man, Tobor the Great would have made a fantastic Mystery Science Theater episode. I wish that had happened.
Oh yeah, there's a lot to riff on in this one. So, yeah, if anyone out there connected with MST or Riff Tracks is listening by any chance, put this one on your radar if it's not already. All right, the screenplay for this one, screenplay credit goes to Philip MacDonald, who lived 1901 through 1980, Scottish screenwriter and detective novelist, probably best known for adapting the novel Rebecca for Alfred Hitchcock's film adaptation in 1940. He also was one of multiple uncredited adaptation writers on James Whale's The Bride of Frankenstein from 35. Wow. Though I'm not really sure. I'm not super clear on exactly like what the chain of custody happens to be with that particular screenplay.
Uh-huh.
He was also one of the screenwriters on 1945's The Body Snatcher, starring Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi. And he also wrote for Alfred Hitchcock Presents and Thriller.
I have mixed feelings about the screenplay in this movie. I mean, on one hand, I would say it's very of its time, and it doesn't really like wow you in terms of character depth or anything, but it has a certain kind of sparky efficiency to it.
Yeah, I mean, especially if I'm thinking about this film and comparing it to some of those various serials that came out back in the day, you know, the 1950s action-adventure serials, some of those are really dreadful and just a real bore to watch, even if they have fascinating elements to it. I feel like this movie, it moves along, and it has its techno-babble, as you might expect, but for the most part, it's techno-babble that you can nod your head to. it didn't feel as much of a skull scratcher as some techno babble tends to be, and I don't know. It had kind of a sense of humor at times, so I feel like the script is better than you might expect, and better than would be required.
I agree. It is. I mean, it does have lots of unintentionally funny stuff in it, but it also it works. It works on its own terms.
Yeah. Also, a story credit goes to Carl Dudley, who is also the executive producer, who lived 1910 through 1973, producer and director of a lot of documentary shorts, mostly. So maybe this is where we get the title. Maybe Dudley was like, hey, I've got an idea for a film. You spell robot backwards, you got Tobor. Let's call it Tobor the Great. Give me a script.
I mean, I think this was also the era of people blowing your mind with a vampire named Alucard and stuff like that.
Yep. All right, let's get into the human cast here. Our star is the actor Charles Drake playing Dr. Ralph Harrison.
One of our classic 50s rectangles. Just love him.
Yeah, this is Dr. Harrison is tall. He's loud. He smokes and he can land a punch. So pretty much just your standard hero stuff for a picture like this.
Mm-hmm.
This is all that was required of a male hero during this time period. So Charles Drake was active from the late 1930s through the early 1980s. His biggest films were probably 1945's Conflict, starring Humphrey Bogart, 1950's Harvey, starring Jimmy Stewart, and 1968's The Swimmer, starring Burt Lancaster. Oh, and also 1967's The Valley of the Dolls.
Oh, okay.
He also popped up in an episode of the original Star Trek. I haven't seen the episode in question, I don't think, but you can find images of him in like a Star Trek captain's uniform, you know, slouched Shat style in the captain's chair. And and he was also in 1953's It Came from Outer Space.
Now, this one is weird because the main two characters, I would say, the two adult characters are Harrison here, played by Drake, and this other guy, Dr. Nordstrom, or Professor Nordstrom, who we'll get to in a second. And I would think the normal dynamic you would do in this movie is you'd have Nordstrom as the egghead professor, and then you'd have a sort of square military man to be his younger man of action counterpart. But instead of making a military man, they make him another scientist. And I don't know if he really reads as a scientist. His scientific credentials almost seem like an afterthought here.
Yeah. He reads far more like a military man. He's tall, loud, smokes, and can land a punch. Those are his main skill sets. We don't see him really doing much in the way of research.
Okay, but we should get to the real egghead of the movie. Professor Nordstrom, played by Taylor Holmes, who lived 1878 to 1959. Taylor Holmes was an actor of stage and screen who appeared in a ton of Broadway plays, had a film career that began in the silent era. And in the realm of talkies, it looks like he did a bunch of crime and noir films, but also some romantic and screwball comedies. The main titles that jumped out at me from his sound era list were, he was in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes in 1953, which is a classic Howard Hawks comedy starring Jane Russell and Marilyn Monroe. He also did some small voice roles in a couple of Disney animated films of the 50s, including Lady and the Tramp and Sleeping Beauty. He was also in a film noir I've never seen called Quicksand, but it caught my eye because of the synopsis. It apparently stars Mickey Rooney as an innocent auto mechanic who falls for a femme fatale played by Gene Cagney, and as a result, he must turn to a life of crime, and he ends up embroiled in a blackmail scheme with Peter Lorre, who plays a penny arcade proprietor named Dramoshag. And Taylor Holmes is in there somewhere. I think he plays a lawyer.
Oh, well, this sounds great.
I don't know if I'm a Mickey Rooney lover, but I am a Peter Lorre lover. And seeing Mickey Rooney turn to a life of crime does sound hilarious.
Yeah, I'm on board. I was looking into this actor a little bit. I think this may be his only performance in a sci-fi or a horror film. It's possibly I'm missing something there, but yeah, it seems like he's. Yeah, more of the comedy noir sort of a area, but yeah, he plays Grandpa Nordstrom in this, Grandpa the scientist, and he's pretty delightful. It's the kind of role that I think could otherwise be very dry and uninteresting, but he gives a little pep to old Grandpa here.
Well, he brings a very stagey energy to the role. You can tell this is a guy who did not begin on screen, but began on stage. So he like projects, and he does a very he does a very stagey kind of voice. And this relates actually to a second unexpected holiday tie-in for me personally with Tobor the Great. So the whole time I was watching this movie, I kept thinking that the actor playing Professor Nordstrom seemed oddly familiar, particularly his voice, which is strange in a way that I associate with some actors who began on stage or in silent film and made the transition to talkies later in their career. And I was thinking, where did I recognize him from? And beyond that, why am I weirdly associating Taylor Holmes' voice with Vincent Price, even though he sounds nothing like Vincent Price? Well, the answer came to me when, echoing through my mind, I began to hear Professor Nordstrom saying, "Christmas, bah, humbug." And bingo, I give you the 1949 made-for-TV Charles Dickens adaptation, The Christmas Carol. Yes, you heard me right. Not A Christmas Carol, like the novel is called, but The Christmas Carol, for some reason, sponsored by the Magnavox Company. It stars Taylor Holmes in a world-historically hammy performance as Ebenezer Scrooge. They also spell Ebenezer wrong in this version with two E's, unlike the novel. And it has Vincent Price as the narrator. So it like opens on Vincent Price sitting on a couch reading a book, and he's like, everyone loves Charles Dickens. And then starts to tell the story. And I don't know if maybe we can get a little sample of what Taylor Holmes as Scrooge sounds like.
Humbug! What's Christmas to you but a time for finding yourself a year older but not an hour richer? Every idiot that goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled in his own pudding.
That's pretty great, and you're missing the visual here of him in some of these scenes, like, you know, squirming on his lounge chair as he witnesses Marley's ghost before him.
Yes. Yeah, it's good. This adaptation, by the way, is less than 30 minutes long, so they really packed the story
in.
Oh,
wow.
It does not take long. Maybe we should feature this for like a holiday special on Weird House or something.
That's great. I mean, that may be beating out Disney Christmas Carol, which I've long admired for nicely compressing a Christmas Carol into a short show that can be watched in one setting.
I mean, I got to say, I'm a sucker for A Christmas Carol. I love it. It's a classic. It still gets me. I love Muppet Christmas Carol. You know, I don't care if you judge me for that. I'm all on board. But this version is, it's not the best, but it is worth seeing for its own charms. But anyway, this Ebenezer Scrooge here is also our professor for the film. He is the creator of Tobor.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeart Radio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage. A 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, now we also have the character of Janice Roberts, played by Karen Booth, who lived 1916 through 2003, an American actor who also appeared in 1947's The Unfinished Dance, as well as various action, Western, and noir films of the day. How would you describe this character? She's there. She asks questions and all.
Yeah, as with a lot of 1950s sci-fi movies, the female characters kind of get a raw deal. And Janice Roberts plays Professor Nordstrom's daughter, who is the beautiful mother of our annoying child character, Gadge, who we'll get to in a minute. But she I don't know. I mean, she gets introduced and she mostly kind of asks questions. She's like, oh, you know, oh, could Tobor hurt someone? Or she's like, you know, why would anyone want to steal the secret of Tobor? Or at one point, the child gets invited to a show at a science museum, I think, and he can bring anybody with him. And it's, and he's like, well, I would take you, Mom, but you probably wouldn't understand it. And she's like, oh,
yeah. Yeah. There's so, a lot of stuff like that. Or she's asking like, well, how do the security systems at Grandpa's house work or something like that? Like she asks a lot of questions where you would think this would have come up at some point in the past.
Yeah.
So yeah, she doesn't have a tremendous amount of agency in this film.
She does have a tremendous scene of shaking hands with Tobor, which is especially funny when you see what Tobor's hands look like.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad she wasn't mangled by this. All right. Well, we mentioned that she's the mother of Gadge. Gadge is the nickname. Gadge is in Gadget, right?
Right. Yes.
Yeah. The nickname for the character, Brian Roberts. Brian Roberts is played by Billy Chapin, who lived 1943 through 2016. Child actor, probably best known for his role as young John Harper in the 1955 thriller, The Night of the Hunter, starring Robert Mitchum.
Oh, man, what a classic. I love Night of the Hunter. That is a like the pinnacle of cinematic menace. Robert Mitchum in that movie is evil incarnate. Love it.
Yeah, yeah. Even if you haven't seen the film in full, there's a very good chance you've seen stills or clips with Robert Mitchum's villainous character kind of stalking and intimidating these two children, this young boy and this younger girl. And yeah, that's Billy. That's our actor. He's most well known for that, but then we also have Tobor.
I think I recall Billy Chapin being good in Night of the Hunter, so I think he's very annoying in Tobor, but I think it's not his fault. I mean, that's how the character's written. He's just saying, he's throwing out gee willikers all over the place.
Yeah, yeah. He was one of three child actors. His siblings were child actors as well. Michael and also Lauren of Father Knows Best. They all were actors. Billy did a lot of TV work, some film work and stage work up into the late 1950s. Including Dragnet and Leave It to Beaver. And he apparently started acting as a toddler and appeared on Broadway as a toddler. So pretty impressive.
Wow.
All right. We do have our villains in this film. And our villains are, of course, do they ever actually say they're Soviets or Russians? Or it's just
I don't think they ever say Russian or Soviet, but that's obviously implied. It's clearly what they're going. It's the 50s and they have Russian sounding accents, or at least Eastern European sounding accents. And they're implied to represent a quote, different form of government and so forth.
When you look at films from this time period, especially if you have an actor who either is of Eastern European origins or can use such an accent, inevitably they're going to be playing villains. They're playing some sort of a menace or a threat, with some rare exceptions here and there. But yes, our villain here is the man with rimless glasses. I don't think he has any other name. That's how he's credited, played by the actor Stephen Gary, who lived 1904 through 1973. This is our lead enemy agent who's trying to get his hands on some Tobor technology. I thought this was a very fun performance. Gary was born in Austria-Hungary, though his birth city, Uzhhorod, is now part of Ukraine. But he was a prolific actor who played a lot of European villains, though sometimes he played more of a comic role. He did a number of comic roles as well. He appeared in All About Eve, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, Spellbound, as well as 1943's Phantom of the Opera, just to name a few. And to a much lesser extent, he also appears in Jesse James Meets Frankenstein's Daughter from 1966. He also starred in the noir film So Dark the Night from 1946, which I haven't seen, but apparently he's the lead in that. So, like I say, there are some exceptions here and there for actors like Gary. So I'm kind of interested. After seeing him in this, which is surely not the ultimate showcase of his skills, I'm very interested to see some of his other work.
I mean, his performance in this is, for most of the film is limited to like sneaking around in the background, kind of looking sketchy and peering over things at people. But then at the end, when he has to be truly menacing, like he captures some hostages, he's good.
Yeah. Yeah. I was a little afraid of him. He reminded it. I mean, this is, I'm being reminded in the wrong direction here, but, while the villainous, SS agent in Raiders of the Lost Ark,
yes,
played by
yes.
Ronald Lacey. For the most part, we tend to associate that character as being a Peter Lorre-esque character. But I was reminded of Ron Lacey's performance watching Stephen Gary in this film.
Absolutely, me too. Same thing. It's similar glasses and similar mannerisms.
Yeah. Now, there's another actor worth mentioning here, and that's Peter Brocco, who lived 1903 through 1992. And he plays, this is uncredited, but he plays Dr. Gustav, who is the doctor that's hanging out with the enemy agent. So he's like a foreign scientist who can't wait to get his hands on this advanced American robot technology.
Yeah, he's there to, I think, do due diligence on the ground. They're there to try to steal the secrets of Tobor, and he is there to check and make sure that they're getting the secrets of Tobor correct.
Yeah. And Brocco here is interesting because he has a very distinctive look. Character actor, very gaunt-looking face. Mm-hmm. So you can easily imagine he's the sort of guy that maybe got picked out of the lineup to get thrown into films and bit parts here and there, but ultimately ends up popping up in quite a few films. He was very active from the early 1930s through the early 1990s. Did a lot of smaller roles in TV work, including spots in the original Twilight Zone, the original Outer Limits, Thriller, Star Trek, Night Gallery, and more. But he also pops up in some pretty well-known films. He plays a character in 1960's Spartacus. He's in 71's Johnny Got His Gun. He's in 73's Papillon. And he has a fairly memorable performance in 1975's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Is he a guy who like never talked or like only said one thing or something?
Yeah, I believe so. I think he may be in a wheelchair. He's an older guy by that point. Yeah, has a beard, but you can still see the gaunt face. He always had this kind of gaunt, kind of skeletal appearance that, again, a great touch for a character actor to have, because whether it's a bigger part or a smaller part, you're liable to wind up on screen.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, the music on this one, there's not much to say about the music here, but it is by Howard Jackson, who lived 1900 through 1966, a composer credited with some 477 works on IMDb, including 1936's Mr. Deeds Goes to Town.
Okay.
All right, well, let's get into the plot of Tobor the Great.
Begins with some nice Flash Gordon-style titles. You know, it's like, I don't know what you call this thing, where it looks like paintbrush strokes. It's got the little jagged edges.
Yeah, like it's painted on the side of a circus tent.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Roadside attraction, that's what I would call it.
But then, when you go into a movie, okay, it's 1954, how are you going to start this thrill ride? We got to get lectured while being shown a bunch of stock footage.
Oh, yeah, robust stock footage intro in this one. Lots of shots of science and war going on.
So it begins, it says, "This is a story of the future, but not the very distant future." And then it shows a nuclear explosion.
They were really always really quick to bust out an atomic explosion in films like this.
Yeah. So it is a story that might have taken place the day after tomorrow. Like all stories of the future, however, its beginnings lie far back in the past. And then it shows some clouds that look like they are ready to start speaking to Moses. It's just shafts of light punching through the cloud tops. And then the narration goes on. "As far back as the first man on Earth to gaze at the stars and wonder someday how he might travel to them. Travel through space." And then, of course, we see space. They love that. Just some stars on a black background. So it would seem immediately like this is going to be a movie that's taking place in space. But no. Back to a shot of the Earth ball. You see like Earth suspended in the void. And then the narration goes on. "In the years after the Second World War, two basic patterns began to influence the growing science of space travel. Rockets or guided missiles grew larger and larger." And then we see a rocket take off. "And then atomic power plants grew smaller and smaller." And here we are treated to some obvious stock footage of a submarine being launched. I guess this is supposed to be a nuclear submarine being launched like down a jetty into the water. You can see in the foreground there's a General Dynamics plaque, but I wonder what event this is actually from.
Yeah, this I feel like you shouldn't depend on this film, even in the 1950s, to learn about like the history of technology in the 20th century. But you might accidentally learn something if you were watching this, I don't know, at the theater back in the day as a child. None of this feels completely off the ball.
Sure. So they're saying, yeah, atomic power plants are getting smaller and smaller, compact enough to be contained in a submarine, and finally in a rocket ship. Immediately, by special order of the president, a new agency was formed, the CIFC, Civil Interplanetary Flight Commission. So, with almost unlimited funds voted by Congress, and then what are you going to get? Of course, a shot of the Capitol building. Yeah, why not? This commission began its task, research in new fissionable materials, more research in non-fissionable metallic alloys to make rocket tubes that would not be melted like wax by their own atomic blasts. Sometimes mishaps occurred. Men paid for them with their lives. And then we see a rocket crash. But the work went on, experiments in celestial navigation, astrophysics, aerodynamics, until finally only one obstacle remained. That, it turned out, was the oldest obstacle in the history of mankind.
The human factor.
The human factor. So we begin the action of the film concentrating on the human factor. What's so bad about the human factor? Well, we're observing a bunch of scientists performing a centrifuge test on a guy in a flight suit, subjecting him to G-forces that make his face into a profound deputy droopy, while various cold-hearted pipe-smoking scientists look on. And this experiment continues in its cruelty until our hero, Dr. Ralph Harrison, this is Charles Drake, he barges into the room and he orders the experiment halted at once. And by the way, I thought this was interesting choice. The guy they have picked out to be the astronaut in the G-forces test here is not like a young test pilot in peak physical condition. I'd say he looks like a roughly 58-year-old mailman.
Yeah, he reminds me very strongly of my grandfather. My childhood memories of my grandfather. Does not look like this guy needs to be in a centrifuge, and also is probably not the best candidate for making rash decisions about whether humans should be involved in space travel at all. At the same time, though, this whole thing about the human factor, this is kind of insightful, and this is something we've come back to on the show, but on Susceptible Your Mind before discussing space travel, is that, yeah, in a lot of cases, you wind up with the question, is this worth trying to send a human being out into the void with? Our bodies have evolved to thrive not only on Earth, but within a very specific layer of the Earth's surface, within a very specific layer of the Earth's atmosphere. And sometimes it just makes more sense to send something that is not human out there to do our work amid the stars.
And this is sort of one of the discoveries of the movie. Like, we haven't gotten there yet. At the outset, it's basically like, well, you're either going to have humans going into space or you're not going to explore space at all.
Yeah.
Now, Harrison comes. So after he stops the experiment, he gets up in the face of these white lab coats, and he says, "Under other forms of government, men are killed or crippled every day in experiments like this. Well, I won't stand by and see manslaughter become policy here." And then this guy with a pipe hanging out his mouth says, "I resent that. These men are volunteers. They know what they signed up for." So begins the philosophical conflict, and it seems the situation of this film is that the consensus of scientists is that we must liquefy all astronauts in the name of progress. And Dr. Harrison challenges the status quo with a bold new agenda, proclaiming that astronauts should not be slaughtered. But in so doing, he fiercely butts heads with a bunch of sadistic pipe guys, and that's where we are when the movie begins. So Dr. Harrison tries to run his gripe up the chain. He tries to go to the commissioner of the agency, and he's like, "I won't stand by while we do these cruel experiments and punish men's bodies in this way." So he's going to tender his resignation. But while he is doing that, he is overheard by a shadowy figure behind a frosted glass doorway. And later, this guy who's listening in comes to find Harrison at his home. And when he does, he is dressed like the judge from Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
I was really, this was a scene too, very early in the film, where I was kind of taken aback by just how old most of the actors I was seeing on screen were. Because not only the test pilot guy, but the guy he goes to, the boss, is pretty old looking. And then here comes Grandpa, who of course is rather aged himself.
Well, it's true. Yeah. But I guess, you know, the 50s were hard on the body. So some of these people may look older than they actually were. I don't know. But anyway, yeah, so he's visited by Professor Nordstrom here, who introduces himself, and it turns out they share a common dissident belief that astronauts should not be killed. And Nordstrom says, you know, before we prepare men for the conditions in extraterrestrial space, we've got to know what those conditions are. No, not guess. And Harrison agrees, but unfortunately, there's just no way to do it, right? In order to find out what the conditions in space are, you got to send human pilots up there in spacecraft to check. And Nordstrom is like, nope, I have a better solution. Join me and we can work on this together. So it seems like they're going to team up. They're going to figure out how to do it. And after this, we see a scene in what appears to be an airport restaurant, but it is incredibly swanky and spacious. I've never seen an airport restaurant like this.
Yeah, not like this. So this is a different age of air travel. This is the kind of place where you'd go to get your steak dinner, your half a dozen oysters, and a few martinis before boarding your rickety flight.
Yeah,
but already this whole business with the explaining why we need to have humanoid robots. I feel like I've got to go back to the screenwriter on this one. I got to go back to Philip McDonald, because this really feels like the producer Dudley coming and saying, "All right, I need a picture in which we have a robot befriending a child." And he comes up with a rather entertaining and almost really thought-provoking way of getting there, instead of just having something like traditionally stupid and action serial happening, like, oh, Grandpa's a scientist, and oh, he happens to have a robot. Well, no, why does he have a robot? This film bothers to answer those questions.
Yeah, he could have invented him as a robot butler.
Yeah, that would be more in keeping with certainly the action serial motif. Like in The Phantom Creeps, for example, starring Bela Lugosi, the mad scientist in that has an evil humanoid robot, but it seems like that's just what you do if you're a sci-fi mad scientist. You're going to have a various gadgets laying around the house, including the humanoid robot.
Yeah, why not? But instead, this addresses a real issue. And of course, you know, almost all of our space missions now are, in fact, uncrewed. They are performed by robots, though in a different way than this movie imagines. This movie imagines spacecraft with like cockpits that are piloted by humans and have steering wheels, basically. And you would get a humanoid robot to sit in the cockpit and guide the spacecraft, instead of just the spacecraft itself being a robot.
Yeah, though you could imagine an update of this where if you had something that was, I guess, less like a metallic human and more like, essentially more like some sort of a cloned bio-android sort of a situation, where you could have something that could be in the place of a human space traveler, not only to handle the equipment, but also to test like how dangerous the environment is to the human body or something.
Yeah, and in a way, I think that's sort of what they're getting at. I mean, it sounds like the purpose of Tobor, I mean, we haven't even gotten to this reveal in the plot yet. We're getting ahead of the plot. But the purpose of Tobor, I think, is supposed to be to fly missions to test what space is like and figure out what the hazards are, so that we can know that in advance of sending humans.
Right.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeart Radio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
But okay, we got to get back into the do things more in order here. Okay, so Nordstrom and Harrison, they're sitting in the swanky airport restaurant. They're discussing their plans. And the big thing is that this project is top secret. Nobody can know about it until it is perfected. meanwhile, we've got a sketchy looking guy in a fedora and rimless glasses watching on from the table behind them. And then they are joined at their table by Gilligan, the science editor of Transglobal News Services. And I appreciate that this film takes a firm and consistent stand against the free press. The journalists in this movie are represented as nasty, opportunistic, and disloyal to their country. Just rats to the core. Mm-hmm. And Harrison, when Gilligan sits down to talk to them, you know, he wants the scoop, of course. He's like, what have you been working on? And Harrison just reams Gilligan because journalists reported publicly on secret atomic tests and things like that. And so I think it's supposed to be a great relief later when we see a journalist get smacked by Tobor during a demonstration. But Gilligan, he's just like, hey, you're in the business of smashing atoms. I'm in the business of selling newspapers. If Uncle Sam doesn't know how to keep his secrets, that's his own tough luck.
And Harrison, to be clear, Uncle Sam here in the form of these two characters are discussing top secret materials at just a random airport restaurant within earshot of enemy agents and the press, which you know is one of the more realistic things about this film, I guess.
Oh yeah. Harrison, of course, doesn't like him at all. He's like, he's like, I guess it doesn't matter how much aid and comfort you give our enemies or how many of our side get killed. I think we got some pretty firmly conservative politics going on in this film. It is not happy about journalists reporting on top secret research. But anyway, so Gilligan gets invited to a demonstration of Nordstrom's new project, of course, along with all the other science journalists, which he's not happy about. He's like, I wanted an exclusive. And Nordstrom's like, nope, we're going to show you all at the same time. And meanwhile, the man in rimless glasses is looking on with keen interest.
Oh, yeah. Stephen Gary here. So good. This is the first scene where I'm like, oh man, this is totally the bad guy from Raiders.
Totally give me that intrigue. Mm-hmm. All right, so then we move on to the Nordstrom estate, where frankly most of the rest of the movie will take place. It's like a compound that's surrounded by an electric fence, and it's got all these gadgets for defense that we see in action later. But when everybody's coming in there, Harrison arrives, and Professor Grandpa here introduces Dr. Harrison to his daughter, Janice, who he says runs this household with a rod of iron. But it doesn't seem like it. When do we see her running anything with a rod of iron?
Yeah, she's very polite, very, very pleasant.
It's almost like, and then we see them, you know, Harrison and Janice standing together in a frame. And while it's basically like Grandpa's like, all right, now you two go fall in love.
Yeah.
That never happens, as I recall, in the film, but it seems like it's almost like you have to at least imply it.
Right. Like, how else would you shoot this scene unless you were going to imply that they were falling in love with each other? Why would you have a male character and a female character on the screen at the same time otherwise?
Yeah. But then we also meet the grandson, Brian, a.k.a. Gadge, who is a sort of Wesley Crusher-esque boy genius who knows everything about everything. He's just a gee-whiz, gee-willikers with science and machines.
Yep.
Oh, and they also have, I think, a German butler named Carl, and Carl is a real Debbie Downer. Yeah. When Carl meets Harrison, he's talking about Gadge, and he goes, "The boy is an imp of Satan, but what a brain! He'll be greater than his grandfather." But inside, we see Gadge's genius. He shows off by demonstrating that he has figured out how to open Professor Nordstrom's bat cave, which is a very involved process that goes on way too long, involving a bookcase and like touching different parts of it.
Yeah, yeah. Though they did put in a lot of work to create something that was a little different than the standard tip a book, open a secret chamber sort of scenario.
Yeah, yeah. Instead, it's like you got three different things and you got to do them in different orders and all that. Mm-hmm. And so Gadge is congratulated on his cleverness for opening up the laboratory, but he is not allowed to come down and see it.
And he honors that. He's a good boy in that he will not just go down the strange spiral staircase to Grandpa's dungeon. But as we find out, he's not above spying on Grandpa's dungeon.
Right, with a listening device that he like ropes through the floor.
Yeah.
And then for some reason, there's a scene where Gadge talks to a grandfather clock. Like they've got an Alexa, basically.
That was interesting. Yeah, it's basically an Alexa sort of situation.
The clock still has a clock face, so he could look at it and it would tell him what time it is. But instead he says like, "Clock, tell me what time it is." And it replies with an automated voice, which sounds like Taylor Holmes, by the way. So it's like, you know, it is 1:30.
This is great. I mean, this is prophetic. This is exactly where we are now.
So anyway, we're heading up to the big demonstration, the big reveal. What is it Professor Nordstrom has been working on? So we've been talking about Tobor, but the movie has given no hint of Tobor or robots at all so far. Cars start arriving. The journalists are showing up to see this demonstration at Nordstrom's compound. And Carl stands guard at the gate with a shotgun.
Yeah.
Seems kind of extreme. And he does a kind of papers, please routine for all the approaching vehicles. And then we see one of the vehicles. Hey, wait a second. That's not a journalist. That's that creepy guy from the airport with the rimless glasses.
Yep.
And he's smoking a pipe. And now here I wanted to do a brief pipe digression. I think it's interesting that several characters in this movie smoke pipes. And they are all villains of one sort or another. You got the creepy communist spy, and then you got the cold-hearted scientist from earlier who wanted to murder the mailman with G-forces. So is there a reason for this? Was pipe smoking associated with cold-hearted treachery in 1954?
I don't know. I mean, nowadays I think of pipe smoking, I think of like Sherlock Holmes or something.
Yeah.
But at the time, yeah, you think back on our various heroes, a lot of the times they're smoking, certainly, but they're smoking cigarettes.
Yeah,
I guess you have characters smoking cigars as well. But yeah, it would be interesting to read like a breakdown of like the cinematic language of tobacco choices in 1950s cinema. Like, yeah, because there does seem to be a division here. You got your pipe smokers, your cigarette smokers. And I guess that's all we really see. We don't see anybody trooping around with cigars or a hookah or anything.
Yeah, it almost seems like, you know, the cigarettes are, I got this cigarette habit when I was in the war. And, you know, that's like an honorable, manly kind of way to smoke. But the pipe smokers are these kind of untrustworthy intellectuals.
I think that may be it. There's an intellectual air to it, which, despite our hero being a scientist, he has more of that machismo to him, more of that soldier mentality. So it makes sense that he's just he's smoking cigarettes.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so we move on to the demonstration where we're down in Nordstrom's secret lair and all the journalists are gathered in attendance. Again, just a dreadful flock of rectangular men in gray suits, including Gilligan, the unpatriotic journalist from earlier, and the suspicious man in glasses. They're all down here. And Nordstrom explains that they are in a wine cellar, but it looks more like one of the sets from Prince Prospero's castle in The Mask of the Red Death. It's like a giant room with stonework walls and 20-foot-high ceilings.
Yeah, like it was maybe once an actual dungeon, and then it was repurposed into a wine cellar, and then repurposed into a secret laboratory. It was not secret anymore because you just invited the Free Press and some enemy agents there. But I guess Gadge already kind of spoiled it for everyone, so why not?
Yeah, so anyway, they say it's chosen because it is ideal for security and to protect our delicate equipment from surface vibrations. And it's also got a stage and a bunch of light-up gizmos. And Nordstrom's presentation restates the problem we've become acquainted with already. So we need to send spaceships into space, but space may well kill the pilots. But in order for us to find out how space will kill the pilots, we've got to send pilots up there in spaceships. So it's a catch-22. So is there any way we can beat this? Well, Nordstrom says he's going to prove all the critics wrong. And in order to do so, he unveils a large electronic device with a pistol grip. And he presses a button on this device to unveil his creation. And out of a gigantic tube comes, what is this? Why, it's like a man with arms and legs and a head, but it's made of metal. It's a mechanical man.
A mechanical man with an ornate head so large that he will surely topple over.
Yeah. Tobor is top heavy, I gotta say. Mm.
Yeah, way too top-heavy for a bipedal machine. It seems like he should be. They should have played it more like a gorilla suit. But then again, they would just the actor would fall over.
The spy, by the way, the creep in the glasses, is positively drooling while he watches. He's like biting his pipe. And again, this guy should have been played by Peter Lorre. I mean, I like the guy they have, but that would have pushed it over the edge.
Oh, well, it would have pushed the budget over the edge. I bet they couldn't get Lorre at this time.
So anyway, Nordstrom says, well, gentlemen, meet Tobor. Then he explains that Tobor is robot spelled backwards.
Yeah, but it's a cheeky way of doing it. He's a little like, yeah, I know this is lame, but hey, it's robot spelled backwards, which again, it really feels like the screenwriter making his EP's idea work in the film.
Yes. Yeah, the boss said it's got to be called Tobor. So he like lampshades the idea that he named it Tobor.
Yeah. By the way, the remote control, this is a film that loves its gadgets. And I love how the cool little like gun remote control for Tobor itself is contained within like a clear, like acrylic or plastic bread box. And then that bread box on a pedestal has its own specifically tailored dust cover that goes over it when it's not.
Yes.
Used.
They spared no expense.
Yeah.
So Gilligan, the journalist, is like, hey, is this just another movie Frankenstein? That's what he says. And Nordstrom says no. And in fact, Tobor is not even a robot. He's an, quote, electronic simulacrum of a man. And I was thinking, how does that make it not a robot? Doesn't that just describe a particular type of robot?
Again, this feels maybe like the screenwriter rebelling a little bit.
Yeah. By the way, if we go by Baudrillard's definition of simulacrum, it would be a copy or imitation of a thing that no longer exists or never existed in the first place. So chew on that. Mm. Maybe Tobor is designed to stand in for man once man no longer exists.
Mm. I like it.
Okay, but here's the rundown on Tobor. So he's an electronic simulacrum of a man who will be able to safely pilot ships into outer space to document the spine-tingling cosmic hazards that dwell there without putting a human being at risk. And he is currently controlled by this little ray gun device with the pistol grip, but that's only a temporary measure. The range will not be good enough with this thing to control him once he goes to space. Eventually, Tobor is going to be controlled entirely by means of a system with longer range, which is ESP. That's right. You narrow-minded journalists might not even believe in psychic powers, telepathy, extrasensory perception, but not only are they real, they are the protocol for interfacing with my new mechanical Superman. Take that. I did not know. I was not prepared for the psychic robot part.
No, especially after they initially whipped out the control mechanism. You're just imagining just sort of your typical kind of clunky commanding the robot with buttons and maybe some vocal commands. But no, this machine will be powered, well, not powered, but controlled by the human brain. You think it and Tobor does it.
In fact, they say that Tobor is already a sentient being. They say he can feel emotions and he will react by psychically sensing the emotions of others. And there's a hilarious couple of demonstrations they do of this. The first one is they call Janice in to demonstrate Tobor's powers. Basically, the professor is like, I command you to love Tobor. And, they're like, approach Tobor and feel friendliness to him. Feel it in your heart. And she says, I'll try. But what do you know? She does seem to start falling for Tobor. Like, she comes up, she feels the friendliness, and she says, why, he does seem almost kind, doesn't he? And we get a close-up of Tobor's face lighting up with his like, conical bright light, high beam eyes. And then he's got a mouth. Is his mouth supposed to look kind of smiley? It's like a V shaped and in an upturned way.
I don't know. I got more of a skull out of looking at his face, but there is an abstraction to it for sure.
Yeah.
So speaking of which, the eyes glow, and I forget the quote, but there's even a little bit of techno babble in there where the screenwriter basically offhandedly explains why the eyes glow.
Yes.
Which I thought was a nice touch. Like, he really did everything he could to make this work, even though the main intended audience seems to be children.
Yeah, yeah. So Tobor telepathically senses Janice's feelings, the feelings of fake friendship that she has just conjured up, and reacts by shaking hands with her. Except Tobor does not have a hand so much as a plate with three wiggling steel-tipped meat spikes on it.
Yeah.
So he shakes her hand with his meat spikes.
Yeah, and luckily she is not crushed.
Yes. And then let's do another experiment. So the journalists are still skeptical. I think Gilligan's like, hey, could you do that with somebody who's not, a member of your family? This could be a prearranged trick.
Mm-hmm.
So Professor Grandpa is like, hey, Gilligan, do you suppose you could contrive to feel enmity towards Tobor? And Gilligan can absolutely contrive this. He's an expert at contriving. So for good measure, the professor has the journalist grab a fire axe and walk around behind Tobor's back. And then he tells him, really get those enmity juices flowing. Feel hatred for Tobor. And I guess he gets so into the part that the journalist starts to like rear back with the axe, almost like he's going to hit Tobor. But Tobor, he lays the smack down, lays down the law with a righteous backhand and knocks the journalist on his, on his butt. But no, he kind of knocks him over forward.
Yeah, and he seems more like his ego is bruised by this. He's not hurt. If this were RoboCop, things would have gone a little bit yeah. differently. But no, he's mostly just put in his place, and everyone kind of snickers at the journalist who now has to sit down and kind of maybe rub his back a little bit.
Oh my God, I did not realize it, but you're right. This is the precedent for the Ed 209 scene in the boardroom. It's the gun at Tobor. It's just a glitch. I'm very disappointed in you, Dick.
Yeah, no one has to run out in this scene and yell for them to behave yourselves.
Yeah. Nordstrom explains that Tobor feels all human emotions, so he's got friendliness, but then they specify he also feels fear and anger and will act out of self-preservation instinct. So good design. That's exactly what you want in a robot.
Yeah.
I hope this is what they're working on in those, the Google labs right now or whatever. So just making robots feel genuine anger.
Well, coming back to the basic principle behind Tobor is if you are sending a simulacrum of a human being into space to test to see what humans can actually take. A part of the risks are going to be certainly physical, but there's also going to be the emotional ramifications of long-term space travel, especially. So it makes sense that you would want your Tobor capable of feeling these emotions as well.
I suppose so. Who am I to question? Mm-hmm. And by the way, I think I should mention this happens a couple times throughout the movie when people are like, so this robot of yours, the professor will cut them off and insist that they call him Tobor. For if they do not, Tobor may become resentful.
Hey,
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeart Radio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage. A 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi. I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
But everybody's impressed, obviously. But is Tobor ready for action? Well, not quite yet, because there are a couple last things they need to finish. One of them is the long-range transmitting device to control him with your psychic powers. Oh, and then Gilligan, he's like, hey, can we look inside Tobor and see his innards? And the professor says, I don't mind if Tobor doesn't. And then there's actually, I thought, a rather good shot where they like flip open the shutters on Tobor's chest and you can see the machinery inside him. And then you're peering through Tobor, seeing between the slats, and you see the man in rimless glasses on the other side of Tobor peering inside.
Oh yeah, this is a great, great scene. And again, just shows the love and attention that went into creating all the various gadgets and gizmos in this film.
Yeah. And we mentioned, so Gadge has been, by the way, the kid Gadge has been listening in this whole time with some kind of spying device that he dropped through a vent in the floor. And he's like, I gotta see Tobor. I just gotta. So all the journalists leave. And keeping with the theme, while the reporters are leaving, Harrison corners Gilligan and he's basically like, hey, when you publish your article about this, I want to ask that you report only the facts, not a bunch of lies and wild speculation. And Gilligan says, he's like, no can do. I don't tell you how to do your job.
Yeah, such a stark contrast to various pictures where the journalists are portrayed as if not the heroes, at least in a more neutral light.
Yeah, yeah. So meanwhile, of course, we get Gadge. He's got to see Tobor. So he goes down to the lab, gets up to some lab mischief, and he ends up activating and controlling Tobor. And whoops, he doesn't exactly know how to do it at first because he accidentally drives Tobor up the stairs, out of the lab, into the house. Mm. That's not good. Tobor is not supposed to be up on the furniture, but Tobor is rolling all around. He's knocking over lamps. He punches a harp at one point and causes a whole ruckus. But then I think eventually Gadge sort of gets the hang of the control device and then walks Tobor back downstairs and puts him back in his tube. And at the end of this, after all the destruction, Janice is like, my son Gadge, he is bad, bad, bad. But the professor says, no, no, don't you see? He has an intuitive grasp of Tobor. Look how quickly he mastered Tobor. So we already see the seeds beginning of a deep connection between Tobor and his friend, this child Gadge. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Harrison and Nordstrom figure out, wait a minute, there was somebody extra here. There was a spy because there were too many chairs in the room. And they get upset about this, obviously. But then Janice is like, what's the big deal? Who are we guarding against? And Harrison says, well, we built the basic emotional patterns for a constructive mission into Tobor. Just think what would happen if someone else, a potential enemy, built destructive patterns into a few thousand like him.
I mean, in a way, this is rather brilliant. It's like Tobor is a machine, and his disposition is a reflection of the disposition of those around him. Yes. So it's kind of like technology itself. He's as much of a weapon as the wills of those in his presence. And perhaps this kind of comes back to why a small boy has the strongest connection with Tobor, because his connection is pure. It's not this complex array of false emotions and false pretenses, pretending to be angry or pretending to love. Like, this is a young boy. He feels all of these things with an absolute purity, and that impulse goes right into the brain of the robot here.
Yes, his innocence is a benediction on the soul of Tobor.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we got these spies, and so we're going to follow the creepy man in rimless glasses. He drives off, he switches out his license plate, just like James Bond, and he goes to rendezvous with his co-conspirators, which include a couple of kind of doughy guys, like this doughy auto mechanic who looks sort of like a cross between the skipper from Gilligan's Island and Buddy Hackett, and they hang out at a place called the Last Chance Garage. So it is an auto garage that is the headquarters of the communist infiltration unit in the United States. Meanwhile, Harrison and Nordstrom keep working on Tobor. They're trying to perfect things like his manual dexterity and his long-range transmitter. And one of the items on their list is, quote, reaction to space hazard. But one scene I thought was very funny was the scene where they get Tobor to improve his manual dexterity by typing on a typewriter. Mm-hmm. And they it's impossible. They show his hands doing it, and his hands, they're like, he could not press an individual key. They are way too big, but somehow he's managing to type anyway. And he produces a kind of all work and no play makes Tobor a dull boy type sheet. It's just a repeated line over and over in all caps that says Tobor is robot spelled backwards. They also tried to train Tobor to fly a spaceship. So he's doing a pilot simulator program, dodging white hot meteorites. And this test proves too much for Tobor. It's too stressful, and it makes Tobor go berserk, and he starts roaming around trying to hurt everyone until Harrison disarms him by lowering his antenna. And you can tell Gadge feels very betrayed, but they assure him. They say, "Easy, Gadge. Tobor can't hurt us now." And the professor concludes that Tobor suffered what in humans we would call a nervous breakdown. But they say now that his circuits have cooled off, when Tobor wakes back up, he feels terrible remorse for his actions, and he goes to give Gadge a big hug, and we can see the bonds of friendship forming already. From this, the adults deduce that Tobor has concern for the young, and they say that he has mastered, quote, human love. Oh, and at some point in here, they also create a miniature controller for Tobor designed to look like a pen. I don't recall why they do this, but it proves pivotal in the climax.
Yeah, it does become important later. All the no gadget introduced in the film fails to have payoff later on.
But then later this night, the communist saboteurs attack the grandpa compound. How would you describe this sequence? This is a strange action sequence in the middle of the movie.
Yeah, this is another sequence where a lesser film would have just had them like cut through the fence or do something like that, even though it is an electrified fence. But no, they basically come with siege equipment that they've custom built out of what it looks like maybe a tow truck and some ladders and so forth. Like, it looks, it doesn't look cheap. It looks like they really thought this out, and whoever the loving minds behind all the gadgets in this film happened to be, they came up with something believable, something that no petty criminals were putting together. No, this is a crew with international expertise and international funding.
They've got Grond the Wolf's head. It's like, you know, they're coming up with like a truck that's got a whole thing.
Yeah.
But of course, they are thwarted by all kinds of high tech traps and gun. Like, I think Gadge runs out with a Gadge is armed, by the way. This is a child with a gun. And he goes out with a gun, and other people get guns. But also, I think they scare them off with sound effects from a movie. They say like this from the sands of Iwo Jima. They're playing like gunfire sound effects, and the spies get spooked and they run away back over the fence.
By the way, the main heavy on the bad guy side is played by an actor by the name of Henry Kolke, who lived 1911 through 1965. Apparently a former professional wrestler, which totally makes sense when you see him. He's a real like stocky plug of a guy. And I think it becomes very obvious later on when the fight scenes start happening.
Yeah, totally. And he has a great fight scene with Tobor.
Yeah. I'll describe it when we get to it, but it's great.
Okay. Okay. So back at the hideout, the spies are not happy. The main guy, the guy in the rimless glasses, says, "Our employers will not tolerate any more failures on your part or mine." So they come up with a plan. They're going to kidnap Professor Nordstrom and Gadge. And the way they do this is by tricking them into attending a fake event at a science museum. They like send out invitations. They're like, come to this science thing. And when they show up, it's just spies there to kidnap them.
I felt personally threatened by this as someone who has responded to invites from science museums before.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and then it's weird how mostly this movie is very tame. It's, you know, it's not getting really gritty, except in the weird part where they, when they've got the professor and Gadge held hostage and they start threatening the professor by saying they're going to burn Gadge with a blowtorch. What? Yeah.
And we see the blowtorch and
yes,
and you totally buy the threat, that is, of these individuals. Like this is, it gets a little creepy and scary. And you're like, yeah, Grandpa, I think you just need to tell them how the robot works. Cause these guys are not playing around.
Got to divulge the secret of Gadge. Meanwhile, back at the house, they've got all these so at first I thought they're like all these generals at the house. Mm-hmm. And I thought they called in the Joint Chiefs of Staff to like find Gadge after he was kidnapped. But no, they're here for a demonstration of Tobor, not because of the kidnapping, but it just so happens now that they're here and Harrison and everybody finds out about the kidnapping. Now they and their military police escorts can help out with the rescue efforts. So they initiate a search. Meanwhile, the professor pulls a smart trick to summon help. So what's his trick? Well, he claims that in order to divulge the secrets of Tobor, he needs both his hearing aid and his pencil.
The pencil, as we established, this is a pen or pencil shaped device that allows him to somehow control Tobor. I was a little foggy on exactly how this is working.
Yeah, they're not super clear on that. But also his, quote, hearing aid is like a headset that is able to transmit his psychic, his ESP to Tobor, I think.
Yeah, it's like a psychic amplifier so that he can beam his thoughts directly into Tobor and control him. And I guess nobody on this crew of villains has seen a hearing aid or hearing apparatus before. So they're just like, yeah, this Magneto-looking X-Men gadget is totally the sort of thing you put on your head to hear better. Okay.
Yeah, it's Cerebro, yes. Yeah. So this works. It summons Tobor. Tobor breaks free in front of all the generals. He walks right through a window. Everybody is extremely alarmed by this. Tobor clatters out through the front lawn. He walks through the gate. I think he like electrifies the gate with his hands and then it falls over. He smacks a military police guard.
Nice.
And man, things really start popping off here because Tobor gets into an army jeep and drives it.
Yes. And
I can't tell you how many times we rewound the Tobor driving scenes. This is the highlight of the film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Tobor is on full rampage at this point, and it's a delight to watch.
Oh, it's so good. So Tobor's nearly there. You know, he's going for the rescue, but then, at the last minute, the spy figures out the game. He realizes what's going on, and he takes the professor's pencil, and he breaks it. And then we see Tobor, he's walking toward the place where he's walking toward the garage, but then he just stops and he falls limp because the control device is broken. And then they're threatening Gadge with the blowtorch. And it's like, what's going to happen now? Maybe only the power of love can revive Tobor. Mm-hmm. And then there's a scene where I don't know how to explain it other than that Gadge prays to Tobor.
Yes, he prays to Tobor. Like, again, he has this connection with the robot. His purity of thought, his mind is unclouded like all the grown-up brains around him. So he alone, none but the pure of heart, can actually connect mind to mind with Tobor and reanimate him and bring him the rest of the way in for the victory and the rescue.
And he does it. It works. A child's love brings Tobor back to life. It reanimates Tobor's circuits even without the amplification device. It's just pure love energy straight from the child's skull. And so then Tobor arrives on scene and he is ready to fight.
Now, the fight scene is interesting. Now, our main hero, human hero, shows up as well, right?
For the fight. Harrison shows up and throws some punches too.
Yeah. And you... this is where you begin to see why, because again, this robot costume looks amazing and they did so much more with it than you would expect them to be able to do. But asking for a scene of fisticuffs with this thing, you can tell they were asking too much. So they're like, okay, we got to bring our hero in for just some normal human on human combat. And then when it comes to making it look like Tobor can actually fight, well, they have to turn to Henry Kolke, a.k.a. Bomber Kolkovich, the former pro wrestler who's playing the main heavy. He gets the main fight scene with Tobor, and it's very, very evident that Tobor, the actor in the Tobor suit, is barely able to move, able to sort of throw his limbs around. But Kolke, with his wrestling background, he knows how to bump. So he knows how to make every little, like, bare movement of Tobor look like it's really connecting with him and knocking him on his rump. So great job here by Kolke making the robot look strong.
Fantastic. There's one part with a really brutal crotch to head strike on the Soviet Buddy Hackett.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go outside and it's Tobor versus the spy in a car, and ooh, it's fantastic. And Tobor defeats the Red Menace.
Now, is this the wonderful strongman cliche scene where he's picking up part of the car
yes.
and keeping the bad guy from driving off? I love that.
Yeah, yeah. Or I think he lifts the hood off the car, I think. And
oh,
then
yeah, he starts tearing up the engine too, yeah.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Tobor rips the hood off and he pulls out the spark plugs or something.
Mm-hmm.
So after all the bad guys have been defeated, we see Tobor, he picks up Gadge and he like carries him off into the sunset. They're going to be friends forever.
It's very touching. But it's also an interesting contrast to the movie posters, or many of the movie posters for Tobor the Great, which show Tobor carrying a beautiful woman, which of course is the standard monster costume, gorilla costume trope of the day.
Yes.
That's how you sold pictures, is you want to make people think that a woman will be carried by your monster or robot at yep. some point. And so that's what they do on the poster.
Yes. Monster must always have an unconscious woman in his arms. But that's a complete lie. Never happens in the movie. Not even close.
Yeah.
With the enemies defeated, Tobor can now resume his function of being shot up in a rocket to die in space.
That's right. He apparently boards a V2 and via stock footage takes off, goes right up into space.
And we see Professor Grandpa and Gadge standing there looking up as the rocket ascends through the atmosphere. And then we zoom in on Gadge's face and Gadge says, "Goodbye, Tobor, and good luck."
And it's a solid ending to what I thought was a really solid adventure film. I was, again, thinking of this as kind of a film version of an action serial from the day. I was prepared for any level of tedium here. But it moves right along. The acting's pretty solid. The writing is far better than it needs to be. And all the gadgets look great.
Yeah. And, you know, every time they're talking about Tobor, I couldn't get enough.
Yeah. Tobor is great in this. Well done, Tobor.
I take back what I said earlier. Now Tobor the Great makes complete sense, now that we've talked it through.
Yeah. Tobor the Great, Tobor the Savior, Tobor the Ascendant.
Tobor Magnus, Tobor Augustus, Tobor the Magnificent.
All right. Well, Joe, it's been great to have you back in the Weird House again. So glad you're able to talk about Tobor the Great with me here, and wonderful pick.
Yeah, man, it's fun to be back.
All right. Well, we'll go ahead and close this one out, but we'd love to hear from everyone out there. Were you familiar with Tobor the Great previously? Do you have a history with Tobor the Great? Well, write in. We would love to hear from you. Or if you're exploring this movie for the first time, like we did, we would also love to hear from you. Like again, there's a lot to discuss in this picture. Far better than I think some have given it credit for. So yeah, write in. We'd love to hear from you. Reminder that Weird House Cinema is our Friday episode in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. We're primarily a science podcast with core episodes that publish on Tuesdays and Thursdays. But on Fridays, we set aside most serious concerns and just talk about a weird film. If you want to see all the films we've discussed in the show thus far and sometimes get a peek ahead into the future, go on over to letterboxd.com. That's letterboxd.com. That's a fun movie website where folks chronicle the films they've viewed or plan to view. And create various lists. Well, we have an account there called Weird House, and we have a list of all the films we've discussed, so you can check them out.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeart Radio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage. A 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet-sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi. I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.